Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. It's been a historic day in Washington. The House Judiciary Committee has approved two articles of impeachment against President Trump.
Mr. Chairman, there are 23 ayes and 17 noes.
The article is agreed to. The resolution is amended as ordered, reported favorably to the House.
House Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler adjourned today's session after that party line vote. President Trump reacted shortly after from the Oval Office. Here's how he characterized that vote.
It's a scam. It's something that shouldn't be allowed. And it's a very bad thing for our country. And you're trivializing impeachment.
The two articles, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, now go to the full House, where a vote is expected next Wednesday on whether to impeach President Donald Trump. Joining us now for more is NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. She's on Capitol Hill. And Claudia, today's vote was quick, less than 10 minutes after that marathon 12 hours of debate yesterday. What's the mood there right now?
Well, I imagine there's a lot of jet fumes going off in Washington, D.C. today because lawmakers were all expecting, especially on this judiciary panel, to wrap up last night and take off early this morning, but they were delayed. As we mentioned, Chairman Jerry Nadler decided to delay the vote to this morning, and that really messed with travel plans for lawmakers, and I imagine a lot of them have taken off. Now, I imagine a lot of staffers are there on the Hill working on those next steps to come.
Right, right. Yeah, and what do you make of what we're hearing from the president today?
Well, this is not a surprise, what we've heard from the president. He's been very frustrated by the House impeachment inquiry, and he's looking for redemption in the Senate from the House process. He's rejected to participate in the formal House impeachment inquiry, and we should note this started September 24th. It's lasted more than 2 months, and he's opted instead to bash it on Twitter or press interviews or through his White House statements or allies on Capitol Hill. However, he, in recent weeks, along with other White House officials, have ramped up their outreach with Senate Republicans to look at these next steps.
The Senate trial would kick off in January. Republicans have said they want a quick trial. What can we expect from that trial in terms of witnesses and duration after Wednesday?
So we have heard from a lot of Senate Republicans who want to keep this trial very tight, maybe 2 weeks or longer into the month of January, if they have to go that far. One area of resistance, however, is President Trump has made clear he wants a long list of witnesses. He wants a very robust defense. And Senate Republicans have worried that if we do parade this list of live witnesses in the Senate chamber, it could drag this out for several more weeks into the month of February. So that's one point of tension. We could see that resolved over the holiday recess. And it's kind of a wait and see on what that could look like.
Yeah, you know, today's vote, as expected, was along party lines. Is there anyone in the full House or Senate that may cross party lines?
So in the House, we do expect the potential for some Democrats to defect and vote against the articles of impeachment already when we had an initial vote on the impeachment inquiry, whether to move forward with it. Two Democrats voted against that measure, and we're expecting those two Democrats to vote against impeachment once again. These are two folks who are from more conservative and moderate districts, and it's possible we could see more, but not enough to jeopardize these expectations that the articles will pass on the House floor. Now, on the Republican side for the House, we don't expect defections there, but we can't rule them out. On the Senate side, it's a bit of a wait and see. Senate Republicans will largely stick together on what is expected to be an acquittal in the Senate trial process. However, there are some moving targets, such as Senator Romney of Utah, Senator Collins of Maine, and Senator Murkowski of Alaska. Those are some of the wild cards in the Senate process. So it's a bit of a wait and see on what they do. And of course, we imagine Democrats will be voting to convict the president in the Senate, but they don't have control. So that's why we're expecting this acquittal.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a really big question. But with the 30 seconds we have with you, what are really the implications for both parties if this remains a party line vote?
Well, unlike a previous impeachment with President Clinton, Republicans have made this argument that the bipartisan vote when it comes to impeachment has been against the process. So that could give them that argument point, if you will. For Democrats, they are going to stand by the vote. They've been saying their job is to uphold their oath, to protect the Constitution. So for many Democrats, we don't imagine it will endanger their seats, but there's some moderates, some freshman members from more conservative districts that they flipped from red to blue last year that might be a little worried about what this vote could do to their chances for reelection next year.
That's NPR's congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And let's see how people are reacting on social media to this showdown in the House Judiciary Committee. Femi OK is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and she joins us now because it's Friday, and that's what we do on Friday. Hey, Femi.
Hi there, Peter.
So as we just heard from Tanya and Claudia, the impeachment vote moves to the House. There was this lengthy hearing yesterday, and I know a lot of people, myself included, spent as much time watching it unfold on Twitter as on TV. What did you see?
Of course. And now you can do that. And there's, the live hearing there on your phone or on your laptop. So you can tweet and you can comment at the same time, as if we need to spend more time on social media. I felt like what we were seeing yesterday was digging into the positions. It was almost like an informal man on the street or man on Twitter poll and woman on Twitter poll about where the country falls, certainly the country that's online, and how they feel about President Trump and impeachment. No nuance there really at all. And people commenting about how long the hearing actually was. Yeah. How long did it go on for?
All day.
Jeremy Hobson, who you may know, says hosting 14.5 hours of coverage yesterday was a little like taking that new Qantas flight to Australia, except at the end of it, you haven't seen two sunrises and you're still in Washington.
Yeah. And yes, exactly. And you're also feeling a little hungover and jet lagged as well.
That's a lot. But people didn't jump off social. They were still there. They were sticking with it right through to the end.
One of the things that people on social media were talking a lot about was this.
Mr. Chairman, I move to strike the last word.
Move to strike the last word.
Mr. Shabbat.
Strike the last word.
To strike the last word.
Strike the last word. I had to look it up. What did you see?
Well, it's an amendment in congressional hearings. So you can debate an amendment for 10 minutes. So 10 minutes, 5 minutes for, 5 minutes against. But it's a very sneaky way of extending the debate. If you want to add a little extra something on, you say strike the last word and then you can continue debating. People on Twitter and online were actually saying, what does this mean? Auburn Kim came up with a beautiful description. She says it's when you're offering an amendment to an amendment under debate, you get your own 5 minutes to speak. They never even have to submit a real amendment by verbally saying this as a formality, gives them an extra 5 minutes. So it's just like, I need more time.
Just
please.
A chance to talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And then people were turning it into a drinking game, obviously.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Because every 30 seconds or 5 minutes, you were drinking.
Yeah. Your liver would be in trouble.
Another story that we're watching, the disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein reached a tentative deal this week, $25 million with dozens of his sexual misconduct accusers. Now, if a judge approves this deal and all the parties agree, Weinstein would not have to admit to any wrongdoing or even pay out of his own pocket. Instead, the insurance companies pay that are representing his former studio. From what I could tell, a lot of his accusers are not pleased with this. How is social responding?
I'm really disappointed, and of course, I don't need to remind you that a lot of the Me Too movement came from social people sharing, talking, and expecting there to be justice, because so many people actually said, this happened to me too. Lisa Dean, for instance, when she realized that none of the money will come out of Weinstein's own pocket, she says, I don't like this. Barbara Malmert, not enough, me too. And a couple of commenters online were noticing that when Harvey Weinstein was going to court today, this week, he was walking with a walker.
Right.
And they were commenting on the way he looked and then compared it to the way Bill Cosby looked when he was also facing his accusers. And there was some skepticism as to, does he really need a walker? Is he acting? Is he playing a part here? So no empathy for him whatsoever. A lot of anger, feeling that he may well escape justice just by spending all of this money and paying the accusers without saying, I did anything wrong.
Okay, so that is a serious story that we're going to keep an eye on. Finally, I want to ask you about Google. It is out with its top search trends for 2019. This is always kind of fun to listen to or take a look at. Here's a song that topped the list.
Yeah, I'm going to take my horse to the old town road. I'm going to ride.
I guess people have heard that song, Lil Nas X, Old Town Road. What else was popular in 2019?
Well, these are all the top trends for what people search for the most in the year around the world. So for news, it was Hurricane Dorian. For actors, Jussie Smollett, right at the top there. For babies, what cute baby do you think might be at the top?
Yoda.
Baby Yoda. and fashion styles, camp style. And diets, well, the intermittent fasting diet. If you want to find out what was trending the most in the world this year, go to Google Trends and they will tell you.
Femi OK, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You've probably heard of the Freedom Rides when activists took buses from the north to the south to demonstrate against segregation on public transit. But what about the reverse Freedom Rides?
It was one of the most inhuman things that I have ever seen.
Get the full story on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
Sports Illustrated has named soccer superstar Megan Rapinoe its Sports Person of the Year. Rapinoe accepted the award on Monday, but not before calling out the magazine, which has honored a woman just 4 times in 66 years.
Is it true that I am the fourth woman deserving of this award? I don't think so.
This summer, Rapinoe led the U.S. women's national team to its 4th World Cup title. FIFA named her the best female player in the world. And off the field, she's gained celebrity for her activism. She and her teammates are suing U.S. soccer for equal pay with the men. She's been criticized for her national anthem protests and her refusal to meet with President Trump at the White House. I spoke with Megan Rapinoe yesterday, and this is our conversation. Megan Rapinoe, thanks so much for joining us today. Welcome to Here and Now.
But of course, thanks for having me.
I think it's probably fair to say that you had a pretty good 2019.
It's been decent. It's probably up there in the top 5-6 years of my life.
Really? Yeah. I was going to ask you if it wasn't the best year of your life.
Yeah. I mean, like, by a multiple of infinity, it's the best and craziest and most wild year I've ever had.
So I would imagine, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I would imagine the World Cup victory is top on the list.
No, not even close. I mean, that's amazing. Obviously, that was like, that's my job, and that was sort of the objective. We did the thing we were supposed to do, but what we've been able to do since, and the conversation we've started, and the way that we've been able to transcend sport into talking about all these other things, honestly, that matter so much more in The country right now is by far the most rewarding part of all of it.
To that end, Sports Illustrated recently honored you for that work, not only on the field but off the field. You accepted the award this week, and you had some tough words for the magazine on diversity. Tell me more about what you were trying to get at, and if you think that discrimination against women in sports is endemic in the industry.
Oh, it's certainly endemic. It's something that we've been dealing with for basically the whole existence of women's sports. If you think about a publication like that, like they're charged with intaking the news, seeing sports, watching games, whatever, and then spitting back out whatever we feel like is the truth or the stories or whatever. Mm-hmm. So if you only have, X amount of, a small percentage of women writers, a small percentage of writers of color, whatever, then like what truth are you putting back into the world? What stories are you telling? Not that white men can't also tell stories of women and people of color, but I just don't believe you get the holistic story of the truth of sports in America and abroad. And I think there's no greater example of that than I'm only the fourth woman to ever be on the cover.
So, in 66 years.
In 66 years. I mean, that's insane. I'm clearly not the only deserving one. And I would argue, actually, I mean, I think a huge reason why I was even on the cover is for all the stuff off. And I'm a very good athlete. I don't know if I'm like one of the greatest of all time athletes in my sport.
Was it always clear to you that you would be an athlete and an activist?
I think so. I've certainly matured and grown into this role where I would, probably argue that I'm maybe more of an activist than an athlete. And that's certainly something that I bring with me everywhere. But I think being in women's sports demands that you're an activist anyway. So you're usually underpaid. You're usually, not shown as much on TV. There's a lack of investment. A lot of the management and leadership of sports and of the TV industry, all of it is a lot of men. So I think that innate of being a female athlete, you're sort of skins in the game already.
Yeah. And now it looks like you're thinking about getting into the 2020 race, not as a candidate, but as an advocate.
Oh, absolutely.
Really, you've said this week that you were all on board. You want to be on the campaign bus. You want to be on that campaign airplane. Really, literally.
That's me assuming they're going to want me in there. But I feel like even just to like in a sort of, bipartisan way, just like get people to vote, get people more interested, and throw whatever weight behind it I can, I will certainly want to.
Are you ready to endorse?
No, I'm not ready to endorse.
What about what candidates intrigue you?
I think a Warren Harris ticket would be fire. Talk about, two super smart, sharp, women who don't back down to anyone. So that's interesting. Obviously, Bernie is, especially with younger people, I mean, he's like on fire and has been for a long time.
It sounds like you are part of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think this like walking of a moderate line really gets us anywhere. I think that that is trying to play this game with Trump of being electable and, not being too far. But when it's like, really, I think we know that these like radical policies could change the world for the better. So why not go all in on that?
Look, as you well know, politics are ugly. You get involved mm-hmm. with them, mud tends to fly. And some of your fans, I know, were not all that happy when you started kneeling for the national anthem starting in 2016.
So mad.
In solidarity with Colin Kaepernick and the NFL. Also, people were not happy with the way you used an expletive to say you weren't going to be going to the White House.
Yeah.
That's history. Uh-huh. But I do wonder, why not open a dialogue with someone you deeply disagree with, like the president? Don't we need that right now?
I absolutely think we do. And if I felt that there was any genuine bone or thread in his body that would allow for that kind of conversation, then I would absolutely have that conversation. I'm, totally not opposed to talking to any Trump supporters or people on the other side, whatever. I've from a very conservative area and have many conversations with my family all
the time.
Shasta
County, Northern California.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Shout out Redding, 530. But no, I think that he would try to spin it, use it for whatever political gain or whatever personal, really, actually, whatever personal gain that he could. And so I'm not going to allow myself to be duped. I think that we can have a national conversation without having it with Trump, because I don't think he's really interested in having any conversation about how we can make this world a better place for all of us.
Megan Rapinoe, star of soccer. Can we talk about the game?
Yes.
Okay, Tokyo Olympics coming up this summer, 2020. Qualifying tournament is in January, right? So how are you getting ready? Are you ready? How do you feel?
I'm not ready yet, but I will be by the time it comes around. After today, actually, I'm kind of shutting down for the entire year, and then it's really like a shift in focus from, traveling and doing all of this, which I think is very important, not only for myself in the game, but obviously for the world at large. And so that'll shift into, focusing on preparation for the Olympics. And we kind of have to do this all of the time, obviously, with the salary disparity that we have and sort of the lack of salary. We are always doing appearances and ad campaigns and all kinds of marketing and media. So we sort of know how to balance a lot of things at once. But certainly this has been crazier than it's ever been. And I'm looking forward to settling back into my real job.
After such a dramatic World Cup win, do you go into the Olympics, assuming you qualify, just assuming you're going to win the gold medal?
Yes, in a way that I hope people don't take as arrogant or conceited or overconfident. We think we're going to win every game, whether it's like a 5v5 game in training or the World Cup final or whatever it is. That's our mindset. We don't win every game. We're not successful every time, but that's always the expectation. Firsthand, we know it's very difficult to win in Olympics after coming off a World Cup year because of all the stuff that we talked about. Everyone's busy and doing a million things, and certainly this year was wilder than ever. I'll probably force myself on the team in this way, but I think that's our public stance. We think we can win the Olympics, and that's our goal. And we're not going to say, we hope that we can put the best performance. No, we want to win always.
Look, you told Sports Illustrated that one of your biggest fears, first of all, is claustrophobia, which some people might be interested to hear. Ooh. Secondly, that you worry that people will see you as a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
How's that possible?
I just never want to be seen as someone who's like leveraging, especially with the activism stuff. Never seen as
it's
like
more as an activist than as an athlete.
Yeah, more of an activist than an athlete for sure. I mean, I think you get out on the field and you're sort of laid bare and all of it. It's like you're either keeping up or you're not. So that's a little bit different. But certainly in the activist space and in the public space, I never want to be seen as a person who's leveraging all of these really important movements, while understanding that as a white female, I have a different experience in it than Colin has or than other people have in
Colin Kaepernick.
Kaepernick. So I'm here because of a lot of different people's work. And I never want to just like leverage that for my own personal gain.
And you have become such an icon to people. To adults, to children, to young girls, to young men.
So wild. so weird.
Well, and in fact, I think that's worth noting because we asked a 12-year-old girl, our producer Ashley's neighbor, her name is Natalie Alvarenga. Mm-hmm. She loves soccer. We thought, well, what would Natalie ask? And she wants to know what characteristics are important to have a successful soccer career like yours.
Oof. I think you really do have to enjoy it and sort of revel in it all. Like, I get to play a game that I've played since I was a kid and do it for a living, and people pay me for it, albeit not enough. But eventually we'll change that, hopefully, by the time she's on the team. I think you have to have a grittiness and a determination. And then I think you have to be shifty in it, especially as you get older. I think there's a time in every athlete's career where you either get old or you get better.
Well, I think you made a 12-year-old soccer fan's day.
Yeah, very cute. Hi.
Megan Rapinoe, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
And I spoke with Megan in Boston at the Massachusetts Conference for Women. We covered a lot of issues in the conversation, including how much longer she can play. She's 34 years old. And we have a video of her talking about her experience coming out as gay. You can find it at hereandnow.org.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Today is the last day of the UN Climate Change Conference, also known as COP25, in Madrid. World leaders have been gathering to negotiate carbon emissions and the Paris Agreement, which the United States will formally leave November of next year. Greta Thunberg criticized world leaders for their lack of urgency and leadership and called upon the power of the people.
Well, I'm telling you, there is hope. I have seen it. But it does not come from the governments or corporations. It comes from the people.
We spoke with one of those people calling for action to fight climate change, an activist from Ecuador who traveled to Spain to share her community's fight to stop the government there from auctioning off land to oil companies.
My name is Helena Gualenga. I'm 17 years old, and I'm from a small community in the Ecuadorian Amazon called Sarayaku. What got me into environmental activism was just living and growing up in the community. I think that is activism, that's a sign of resistance. I think that the indigenous children that are growing up in indigenous communities, they are almost the most important activists, because they are the ones that are going to take care and protect the forest and the Amazon. The threats that my community has been facing for as long as I can remember are oil companies. Often in the Amazon, the communities are not consulted before the companies enter the territories, and that's exactly what happened with my community. The government supported the oil companies, and together they entered our territory along with military, and my community has had to stand up against these powers in order to protect our forest. So first, the men of the community used to run out to the forest to protect the community from the military, and then later it took to the courtrooms so we could fight it legally, and we actually won a court case against the Ecuadorian government in 2012 in the International Court of Human Rights in Costa Rica. But even though we have that sentence that says that they cannot repeat that again, our community has now again been concessioned to another oil company. And I think there are some huge legal battles coming for my community. I think it's important that indigenous people have come here and that we are represented in spaces like this. But at the same time, I'm really disappointed that we're still being invisibilized, even at events like this, and also that the governments from example, my country, come here and have beautiful speeches, and then there are these things happening, like they're concessioning territories to oil companies and mining companies. So there are a lot of mixed feelings about what's going on here. We're not sure if we're doing everything in our power to actually stop the climate crisis, or if it's going to be enough. It's about my home, it's about my people, it's about my family. I grew up in this indigenous community, and we have this really close relationship to nature, and we live by nature and we live with nature, and that's something that is very important to us. And I know that this is what I have to do, give a voice to the people that have been silenced and the people that don't have a voice.
That's 17-year-old Helena Gualenga talking to us from Spain at the UN Climate Change Conference in Madrid. French union leaders say they're prepared to strike through Christmas if President Emmanuel Macron does not back down on plans to make people work 2 years longer before retiring with a full pension. The plan has sparked the country's biggest strike in decades. For more, we're joined now by NPR correspondent Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. And Eleanor, protesters flooded the streets yesterday. What's it like there today?
Well, today we are continuing in the ninth day of a general strike, and most of the transport is shut down. So there's no metro, or very little metro service, and very few buses. The streets are just packed with people on bikes and scooters and all kinds of rolling wheels that they never used before. People are just trying to get around. There's no protest today, but everything is sort of paralyzed. You can't get anywhere, and it takes hours.
Help us understand the change that sparked these protests. So France's prime minister said the age for receiving a full pension will rise from 62 to 64 in 2027. But they're also moving the country to a single pension plan instead of the dozens that exist right now. What are people so angry about?
Well, I think, first of all, Macron has done some overhauling of the economy and the labor market in France, and people have not liked it. This is sort of like the last straw. So just to give you an example, you know, the government talks about the deficit. I was out at a protest the other day, and one of the placards that was up said, real revolt, fake deficit. Because a lot of the people out feel like this is just more blah, blah to make the working classes pay for everything, and the rich are getting away with it. And they sing these great chants, and a lot of it is just generally about Macron. Listen to this. I got them after the protest march, some people to sing me the song.
On est là, on est là. Même si Macron ne veut pas, nous on est là.
So you say, we're here, even if Macron doesn't want us, for the honor of workers. But that's sort of, you know, it sets the tone. That's what it's kind of all about. And I spoke with Philippe Le Goff there, and here's what he said.
Il dirige la France comme on dirigerait une start-up. Voilà. Et que pour lui, c'est les premiers de cordée.
So he's saying, you know, Macron is running France like a startup. For him, only the brilliant and the best count, the managers, the dynamic people, the rich. He said the rest of us don't matter. A lot of this retirement revolt is about more than just the retirement plan.
Yeah, the unions have really risen up. They say the government has crossed what they call the red line with these proposals. What are they calling for?
It depends on the union. There is a moderate union that has been sort of working with the government, and they want them, the government, to drop that age. The government does want to raise it to 64. And then there's the hardline union, the CGT, that just wants the whole thing to go. I spoke with an analyst. He's a deputy editor of L'Express magazine, Christian Macarion, and he says that Macron needs a social ally. But the problem, Tanya, is Macron doesn't have any social allies, says Macarion. Mm. You know, he's coming across as authoritative, like a king. There's pictures of Macron wearing a crown at a lot of these protests. He's got to get rid of that image. He's got to find allies. He's got to make this look like, you know, the retirees, that the unions are reforming the system because they want to save it.
Mm. Let's broaden this out just a little bit on some of the reasons Macron says that this is important, this is necessary. France's pension spending as a percentage of GDP is among the highest in the world at 14%. Has Macron's government made the case that these changes are necessary for budgetary reasons? And how is that argument going over?
Well, the prime minister spoke the other day, and the prime minister laid it out. He said, you know, we have 1.7 workers for each retiree now. At the end of World War II, when the system was set up, we had four, more than almost five. And actually, what's at the heart of this is there are 42 systems now, and many of them have a surplus. You know, you have all the lawyers in one and the liberal professions, but there's one that's in real debt, and that's the train drivers. And they have like 14 billion euros debt. And we're waiting for this. So the train unions had this great deal in 1945 when it was set up. They had a hardship job. But now it's just not the case anymore. It's not the same thing. And so the whole system is not indebted, just parts of it. And the government wants to make it one and to get rid of this. And the prime minister did announce, we will get rid of the special regime of the train and metro drivers. He said that.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Thank you so much for this update, Eleanor.
You're welcome, Tanya.
In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson woke up this morning with a trip to Buckingham Palace on his agenda after his Conservative Party won a resounding victory in yesterday's election. Johnson formally asked the Queen for permission to form a new government. The Prime Minister will have the largest Conservative Party majority in Parliament in more than 30 years, and he said today that the majority gives him a mandate to do what he's been promising, to take the United Kingdom out of the European Union.
We will get Brexit done on time by the 31st of January. No ifs, no buts, no maybes.
BBC political correspondent Rob Watson joins us now. And Rob, the polls showed us that Boris Johnson was likely to win, but not by this big of a margin, right? What happened?
Well, no, it was part of the margin of error. I mean, the polls suggested that there would be a Conservative majority of maybe around 30, but they also said because of the margin of error, it could be no majority at all or a much larger one. So obviously things went that way. And if you were to ask me then, well, why did that happen? Two reasons, really. One is Brexit. The other one is Corbyn. What do I mean by Brexit? Not that there was some fabulous and intelligent and interesting and serious frank debate about it during the election, but rather this, that if you think about Britain these days, it's like two cakes. One cake represents Leave voters, the other one represents Remain voters from the referendum. And basically what happened is that the cake of Leave voters, Mr. Johnson managed to eat just about all the slices, whereas the Remain one was divided amongst all of the parties. And then the second factor that helped him was Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, he is the most unpopular leader of an opposition party in this country since that sort of polling was first done in 1977.
Wow. So with this majority in Parliament, what kind of clarity does this bring to Brexit?
So I think what it means is that Britain will definitely be leaving the European Union at the end of January. No doubt about that. So that, in a way, is a very big and one of the most significant developments from last night's historic result. Does it mean, though, that we know what Britain's future relationship with the European Union will be? Its diplomatic relationship, its trading relationship, its security relationship? Absolutely not. I mean, that was one of the extraordinary things about this election, an underwhelming, uneventful, frankly rather tedious and trivial election has left all of that stuff, the really big thing about Britain's place in the world and its relationship with the European Union, all to play for. I mean, Mr. Johnson did say ahead of the election that he would rather prefer a more distant relationship with the EU, not to be following its rules and regulations. But I guess we'll see.
Well, now there's not a lot of time to work out a trade deal, which could be just as ugly as some of the fighting we saw over Brexit in the first place.
Absolutely. But I think here is the hope of the Johnson administration. And I think it is the big question, or one of the big questions in British politics. There are so many. Is this. You know, once Britain leaves the European Union at the end of January, even if the more difficult bit is still to do, the trade stuff, really, really difficult, I think Mr. Johnson and others are hoping that will sort of take the sting out of it, right? Yeah. Britain's no longer in the EU. Yeah, there's all sorts of complicated stuff, but, you know, that'll go in the financial pages of the newspapers rather than on the front page. Now, whether it turns out that way, I don't know. It's going to be immensely serious. Businesses in this country are going to be lobbying hard. I mean, an awful lot is at stake, but that at least is the hope.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, says he will not lead his party in another general election. We'll see what his future is. But for people who wanted to remain in the European Union, did this election sort of take their breath away?
Yes, and I think there are three really important things that happened at this election. Number one, as we just discussed, Britain will definitely be leaving the EU. The second was the decimation, if you like, of Britain's main opposition parties, mainly the Labour Party, but also another party called the Liberal Democrats. And what I would guess would be described as the sort of the dismay, disarray and disheartening of those who really would have much preferred if Britain had stayed in the European Union. Now, I'm not saying that those people are going to go away completely. And I think one of the many problems that Mr. Johnson will face is that this is still a country profoundly polarized. And lots of people are really, my goodness, are they worked up about this. I mean, this has got to people's emotions. But I think in terms of, you know, the state of the actual opposition parties and organized Remain, if I could put it that way. I mean, they're in disarray.
Certainly a new chapter yet again in British politics. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Kentucky's new governor has given voting rights back to more than 140,000 felons. Governor Andy Beshear, a Democrat, signed the executive order yesterday, just days after he was inaugurated. Kentucky was one of only two states in the nation with a total ban on felons voting. Now only Iowa has a blanket lifetime ban. Governor and former Kentucky Attorney General Andy Beshear joins us now. And Governor, you wasted no time signing this order.
Well, I wasted no time doing this on my third day in office, but those that have been disenfranchised have had to wait far, far too long. It was important to me at the start of my administration, day three, to make sure that 140,000 Kentuckians that committed nonviolent offenses that have fully served their time get that bedrock right back to vote here in Kentucky. I think it's critically important, not just for democracy, but also in understanding that people can make mistakes, yet they can rebuild their lives, and they ought to have the dignity of voting once they do.
Something interesting. Your father, former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear, signed a similar order in 2015. His successor and your predecessor, Governor Matt Bevin, revoked that order. So I want to ask you, why are you going through this as an executive order instead of legislatively? It means really that this could happen again with someone else in charge.
Well, in Kentucky, the change that's necessary here about automatic restoration of voting rights would require a constitutional amendment. And I fully support that constitutional amendment, but that would take several years to get on the ballot and to go into effect. By using executive order, it means the 140,000 Kentuckians that got their voting rights restored yesterday don't have to wait those extra couple years. But I'm going to be working throughout my term to make sure that we can get that amendment passed so we can make this automatic. And so people in the future don't have to be worried about whether the next governor will continue this type of executive order. I can tell you that as long as I serve, this order is going to be in effect and we're going to restore these rights.
Let's talk a little bit about lessons learned from other places. After Florida gave felons their voting rights back, the state legislature passed a bill requiring them to pay back court fees and fines and restitution before getting the right to vote. And some actually called that essentially a poll tax. Are there going to be any provisions in place in Kentucky to make sure this process goes over smoothly, especially with the 2020 election so close?
It's critically important that we not only provide these rights back, but that we also do it in a streamlined way that doesn't put extra burdens on the individual. We specifically exclude any fees, costs, or restitution. The fact that someone owes money will not keep them from getting their voting rights back, because those that have less money shouldn't have their voices squelched or not be able to vote simply because of that. We're also working on a streamlined process where those that have had their rights restored don't have to fill out any paperwork. We're working to provide information directly to our clerks all across Kentucky, because people have also moved and we might not have current addresses. So our goal is to streamline this process to where someone now who has this right back in the near future can walk into any clerk's office across Kentucky and get registered to vote. No forms, no hassle. This is their right. And as long as they go to register, they ought to be able to vote.
Kentucky also has the third highest voter disenfranchisement rate in the country, and nearly 1 in 10 Kentuckians and nearly 1 in 4 African Americans are not allowed to vote. What else are you hoping to accomplish to change that?
Well, that was one of the compelling reasons in why we signed this executive order and restore these rights so quickly. It is an injustice. It is a racial injustice. And this executive order helps get us on track to righting a lot of wrongs. We also have to make voting easier in Kentucky. It's not just enough that more people can vote. We want everybody out there who has the right to vote to actually vote. And so we're going to be looking at legislation. We're going to be looking at other means to where we make voting in Kentucky so much easier.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about the decision by your predecessor, Governor Bevin, to pardon more than 400 people on the way out of office. Some of those were convicted of violent offenses, including sexual assault. And state attorneys have said that that move was really startling and disturbing and that it put Kentucky communities in danger. What's your response to those pardons?
Well, I've tried to be very careful since I've come into office of criticizing my predecessor, because I believe Kentucky is ready to move on and to move forward. But one of those cases that was pardoned, we prosecuted out of the Attorney General's office. It was an awful case where a young man in high school was attacked, was violated. It was filmed. It was sent out to different people at his school. It's one of the worst crimes that we have seen. And in fact, one of the caseworkers on it even had to get some help herself after working with that traumatized individual. I fully disagree with that pardon. It is a shame and it's wrong.
That's Kentucky's new governor, Andy Beshear. Governor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.